Petaluma, California, 103.3 FM.
You guys ready?
They're always hot.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Wait, there, Janice, you're on.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, how you doing?
Hi, I'm fine. How are you?
Good.
Who are you?
I'm David Glass.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to see you again.
Okay. Welcome to Inside Petaluma.
Yeah.
It's Friday morning, everybody, and Inside Petaluma is here to spend the next hour with you. I'm Cindy Thomas, and co-host Janice Peter Thompson is here, but our other co-host, Jason Davies, I hear is under the weather.
Under the weather, and it's going to rain, and brrr, it's going to get real wet, and
yes,
thank God we got the flood control project finished.
Absolutely. Did you see those clouds off to the east this morning?
Yeah.
Wow. It's coming.
Yeah, a 60-mile-an-hour wind, you're expecting.
It could be worse. You could be in Chicago.
Oh, that is very true.
They have a swing of 100 degrees in the next 3 days.
Isn't that amazing? I know.
That is unbelievable.
I know. I know.
Something has happened to the climate.
Yes. But according to Trump, well, there's no climate change. Look, it's really freezing now.
Yeah.
You haven't quite connect the dots.
Yeah.
Anybody see the movie The Red Sparrow?
No.
It was about a Russian spy. I just kind of wonder if...
Those darn Russians are everywhere.
And I think maybe the Red Sparrow's in the White House.
Here we go.
Yeah.
Oh, I think so. So I just want to kind of bring up a few things that I read in the Argus, and this is actually last week. It was John Burns, and he was talking, thanking the school board, which I had sent a letter to the editor thanking Phoebe Ellis, you know, for her service to the community, and I really appreciated it. But what I was disappointed in with John Burns' wording is he had to attack Lula Bell Sites and her mother. And it could have been a really positive editorial, but he had to go in there and dig, like, you know, they're bad people. They created this problem. And it's almost like because they got involved, the school board changed. Well, I think that's not quite what happened. But it would be nice if it was a little bit more positive.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they served our community, and I thank them for their service, Mike Badley and Phoebe and Sherry Klebowski.
Yeah.
But now it's new people, so we need to move on. But the other
change
thing
is hard for some people.
Change is very hard. But the other thing I want to talk about is last night I went to the Jewish Community Center down at JCC of Marin, and there was a lecture on transgender. And so it was very interesting, and I think it's a topic that I would like to bring forward on our radio show so we can have a parent talking about a parent with a transgender child or finding out they have a child that's transgender. And then, you know, just the whole process, what families go through, what the person goes through. But I think what was heartbreaking was this one man that trans to a woman. It was involved with an evangelical church down in Novato, and her and the son were excommunicated from the church.
Yeah.
And it was really their family. So those are different topics, but I'd really like to touch that topic.
Yep, that's worth an entire show. So
absolutely.
Let's go there soon.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea. Yeah. And then today when David is we're talking, I'd like to also talk about SB 152.
Yes, and as you heard earlier, we have David Glass, former mayor of Petaluma, with us today.
Thank you.
So glad to have you.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
In fact, you were with us on our first show months ago.
You know what? And I wouldn't have that title, former mayor, because there would be no mayorship in my lifetime if it wasn't for people sitting here in this room. So we kind of can walk through that as well. There's a lot of people that made a difference, but the two of you definitely made a difference. And so just kind of want to revisit. I can't say exactly how did it happen, but I can say
Is
a piece. Well, it'll only be a piece of how it happened.
Exactly.
Because there were so many different pieces to that puzzle that we won't be able to hit them all. And I may not even be able to not only recollect, but I may not be aware of all of the pieces of that puzzle. But the first time around, there were a lot of things that fell into place that actually led to my getting elected mayor.
Yeah, that's true, but I'd like to correct one thing. You're not a former mayor. You're a retired
exactly.
mayor.
Exactly. Okay. I didn't want to go there. It's close
enough. Is that
enough.
How it's... Is that
yeah.
How
no, it's retired mayor.
Once a mayor, always a mayor.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. So
my bad.
No, not at all. I just I feel like it's very important to know that you're retired. Lynn Woolsey, when I write her, I say Congresswoman Lynn Woolsey, retired.
Right.
And I'm celebrating that last part of it now.
Yeah, well, there you are.
I'm not really believing that you're totally retired. I still see you as an active person here in the community.
I'm retired.
You're retired.
I'm retired.
I'm retired, but look at me. I'm here every Friday and on Thursday night. And so define retired.
I guess the next fight will have to find me. I'm not looking for it. Yeah. That's retired.
Exactly. I think the significant thing for me is no more alarm clock.
Isn't that something?
I love it.
Yeah.
I threw that sucker out the window. Well, I never looked back.
I'm not quite there yet because we had to go to Social Security this morning. Now I'll go for lap two this afternoon because you find out what you were missing. And I'm hoping we're not missing something when we go for lap two this afternoon because I'm trying to get into the Medicare deal.
Right.
You know, and get signed up for that because in conjunction with my retirement is my wife's retirement. And that was planned on the part of the two of us, but it's like it's time for us to move to that next phase of our life and actually focus on enjoying the time that we have. You know, I don't want to say the time we have left, but let's face it, all of us have a certain amount of time left.
Yeah.
And it's time to focus on that.
Yeah. Well, you have Bonnie is a lovely spouse to have. I mean, she's been great for our community, letting us have you for how many years?
That's
a lot of years.
A lot of years with a 2-year gap.
Right.
Is really the way I guess I would say that.
I mean, you know, it's a family event, even though people don't realize
that. Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of time. I wanted to mention right at the top of this, because we're on some positive things that are happening. I'm looking forward to tonight, and I've kind of, I haven't been out in the community the last month. I think there's time to just kind of just catch your breath. And then now I tonight I'll be back out in the community because I'm going to Black History Month kickoff because I wouldn't miss that. Every year that I was there reading proclamations, I always said this is my favorite event in this community. Dorian Bartley and the Dorian Mode will be there to play the music, and Dorian does a great thing of weaving the story of the music into the story of Black History Month and Black participation throughout Sonoma County and particularly Petaluma. And I've always enjoyed that. And tonight I'm really going to enjoy it because I don't have to worry about getting up there and reading a proclamation and saying anything. I can just go with my ears rather than my mouth and just have my ears and my heart filled up and listen to the Dorian Mode.
Nice.
Yeah, it's going to be great. I love that event. I love the people that I see at that event. Yeah.
Well, last week we had Faith Ross and Gloria Robinson as our guests.
Yeah.
And we talked about Black History Month, but I'm still stuck on the migration. You know, just what they talked about, you know, how the Black communities migrated. Because I talked about myself, which is my family actually immigrated. But when you hear the word migration, they're migrating within our country. And it's just very different than immigration. And plus, they're wonderful women and are true leaders.
You know, it wasn't until 1972 that I actually saw what I would call, now for lack of a better term, a Black ghetto. Because you think you've seen it in California. And then I got into baseball and traveling, and I can remember we flew into Shreveport, Louisiana, and we're taking the bus from the airport to the ballpark. That was the first time I actually had seen what I would call, you know, a Black ghetto. And it was, I mean, it was just amazing to look at as a kid from California looking and all of a sudden seeing something that is so far different than what your perception in your mind of what it would be.
Black communities, they were thriving communities, even in San Francisco and in Oakland and, you know, in other areas in the country. But it was really going in and tearing those communities apart because we wanted to redevelop them. Well, they didn't really need redeveloping. They already had a community. And it was really tearing the fabric of the Black community.
I can remember going into a nightclub in Memphis, Tennessee in 1972. And we had a second baseman. People that follow baseball would remember the name, Lee Lacy, who was from Oakland. Went on and played for years, first with the Dodgers and then the Pittsburgh Pirates. And I think even had a stint with the Oakland A's, if I remember right. very good ball player. We go into a black nightclub, not a black nightclub, but into a nightclub in Memphis, Tennessee, and Lee, being black, was with us as part of the team. He was the only member that was there going that night that was black. And when we went in and they said, "We're not serving you."
Oh, wow.
That was eye-opening for me. This was my first year in baseball, first year really traveling the United States, and particularly areas of the United States that I had never been to, because I had no reason that I would go into those areas. You know, I mean, it just didn't hit my path. But I was shocked that 1972, that a black person could not get served. And everybody got up and left. It was an entire ball club. It was, you know, probably a party of 20 people, because not everybody on the team was there, but a lot of people. Just we all, you're not going to serve him, you're not going to serve us either, and we're out of here.
It's those experiences, they never leave, it's like our, it never leaves our mind, and it impacts us the rest of our lives.
So when people talk, and I'm tonight, to hear Dorian weave the history of the challenges that these people faced, I broadcast in Jacksonville, Florida. And that was a city that when the Dodgers barnstormed north in 1947 with Jackie Robinson, and we just celebrated the 100th birthday of Jackie Robinson. But when the Dodgers barnstormed north, they came into Jacksonville, Florida. That was the only community on that barnstorming tour as Jackie Robinson was breaking the color barrier, and it's before the start of the baseball season, and Jacksonville, Florida would not allow Jackie Robinson to take the field in their ballpark. It was amazing.
Well, unfortunately, some parts of the South still act that way.
Well, and Jacksonville has a history of still acting to that degree. I can remember sitting in the dugout in 1973 with Tommy Aaron, and he set up an interview for me with his brother, Henry. Tommy was a minor league ball player at that time, had played some in the major leagues, and we had the Atlanta Braves come in for an exhibition game against the Southern League All-Stars. And I was so nervous to have an opportunity to interview Henry Aaron, and he was on the verge of equaling and then would pass Babe Ruth's career totals for home runs. But to sit there and see these people so dignified and see the challenges that they face, and Henry Aaron had played in his minor league career in Jacksonville, Florida, long before he made it to the Braves, and it was not a pleasant experience for him. But he was so gracious to this young announcer that was the friend of his brother. And he did the interview with me as if I was, somebody, a world-renowned sports reporter. Yeah. And I wasn't. I was a 25-year-old kid trying to get started in broadcasting. And he was just tremendous, a tremendously polite and calm human being. But the things he went through at that period of time, there were death threats put on him, because people did not want to see a black man erase the records of the great Fambino.
Yeah, welcome to the U.S., and we're kind of going backwards.
Well, so it's Black History Month, but we got to remember from where we came.
Yep, that's right.
And I think the election of Barack Obama showed how far we have come, and also those 8 years and the time that has followed it in a variety of ways have shown how far we still have to go.
That's right. That's exactly.
And then there's Kamala Harris.
That's right.
Or Cory Booker.
Cory Booker today.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's another one.
So we'll see how all this plays out.
Yeah.
Yep.
It's going to be quite, quite a play out.
The event that we're referring to is at the museum over on Kentucky Street tonight, but it is sold out.
It is sold out, and good. I'm glad it is. That's, it ought to be sold
out.
On a variety of levels, the music of the Dorian Mode, the dedication of Dorian Bartley, the event itself kicking off Black History Month in Petaluma. And so how do we find ways to bring people together rather than find ways to divide people, put walls between them, not only of a physical but of an emotional nature? How do we find a way to strip out all of that and move forward? So anyway, I'm looking forward to tonight.
We're all going through a transition.
Yeah.
Every community.
Yeah.
Well, in case you just tuned in, you're listening to Inside Petaluma, and Janice and I have David Glass on the show today, and What else do we want to talk about today?
Well, you know, on the agenda, I was looking at, see, you say you're retired. I am retired, but I still had to look at the agenda and see what are we going to be talking about. The Pauley Class Center is going to go through a transition much like what happened with the Kavanaugh Center, and it's volunteers that will make it happen. And this has been so long in the exploratory stage.
Okay.
To see.
Is this the city council agenda you speak of?
It's on the city council agenda, the Poly Class Center. So what you're going to see happen, I think, and now I'm not in the loop of information, but I was for a couple of decades, so, and this has been going on for a couple of decades, not with this group, with this entity, but it's almost like you keep throwing it against the wall and hope something sticks and you finally move forward. And some great people have a path to move forward with that. I think that you're going to see that thing completely revitalized, remodernized, the red tags lifted over the course of time, the building being used in a way that the naming of that building will be something that will be celebratory rather than a symbol of frustration and loss, which is what, you know, it was starting to take on with all the years going by.
Well, when we had redevelopment money, the problem was it was just outside the redevelopment district to get redevelopment.
And by design.
It was by design. And that building would have been perfect for redevelopment.
It absolutely would have been. What happened was there was fear. Sometimes people are so fearful of the unknown. There was fear that if that side of the street were incorporated into the redevelopment agency, the redevelopment agency, Big Brother, would come in and use eminent domain and change the nature of the neighborhood and confiscate property and all sorts of things. So here it was, across the street, out of the boundary of what could have rectified that situation decades ago.
Exactly.
And would have.
And would have. Yeah.
Would have, just like
institutional knowledge is interesting, isn't it?
The three buildings that constitute the Art Center, where the Smart Station is, the argument of that back in 2003-04 when we were going through it was private business would never waste their money to fix these buildings the way the redevelopment agency actually did do. And when that argument came up, having been in municipal finance and dealt with a lot of redevelopment agencies elsewhere around the state, and I said, that's exactly right. Thank you for saying that. A private business would never do that because under the law of redevelopment, you actually have to make the finding that when left unto itself, that no private enterprise would ever come in and remedy the cure of blight that exists. And that was what redevelopment was for. So the people that didn't want to see the money in quotation marks wasted, we're making the point that private business would never do this, as if it's stupid. You're right, private business will never.
It's a perfect marriage.
So we have to do this. And look what became out of that. Yeah. Those buildings are great.
Exactly. Uh-huh.
Poly Class Center headed the same way with a different tool. It's the wisdom and spirit of people that volunteer in the community that will cobble together the resources and get it done.
Yeah.
And it's exciting.
It is exciting.
So Monday night will be exciting. That's on the agenda. I'm just with a great deal of anticipation. But I haven't read the staff report on it.
Yeah.
I won't be there. It's not my thing. Mayor Barrett will be there. That's great. I'm happy that she is. And I'm looking forward to seeing that thing come out. And all I told the city staff person that I talked to when I saw it on the agenda, they said, we're sorry we couldn't get this done in your time. And I said, that's okay. I said, I just want to be there at the ribbon cutting, not the groundbreaking, nothing. And I don't want to participate. I just want to be there and see it when it's done.
Very true.
Yeah, it'll be great.
I remember when it was a senior center, and Mrs. Porter, the babysitter who babysat my children, she would go to the senior center there. And so, you know, so I have some history with the building.
I've only seen it dilapidated. I never knew it was a senior center.
It was a senior. There was an area that you had the seniors would go, and then I was in the building itself, and there was actually some events that went on. Yeah.
Wow.
So
I've never been inside the building.
It's a beautiful building.
It's really beautiful. Yeah.
So, I mean, so this is kind of near and dear to my heart also, and I was pleased to read that we're going to move forward.
Well, people will never know how many times that got thrown against the wall, hoping something would stick. Maybe during Clark Thompson's time, too, but I can't speak to that because I wasn't there. But I know certainly during my time and during Mayor Torliat's time.
Yeah.
And I'm just glad that the time is coming and that it will happen in Teresa Barrett's time.
Absolutely. And be completed.
Yep.
Which would be great.
And it'll be the volunteers that are stepping up to do it. They'll raise the money and they'll
do it. What group?
I'm not going to speak to that because I might misname them.
Okay.
But it's part of the Poly Class people and let them identify because there's several different entities out there. And so, you know, I'm pretty sure that's how this went.
Right. And it sounds like Cinnabar will maybe be able to use it.
I don't know who all will. I don't know all of the package
right.
of that. So
right.
I don't want to speak to it because it's going to be their thing, not mine. But the way it was set up exploratory through this process was that it would be similar to what happened with the Kavanaugh Center, where you'd sign over either the property or the use of the property for maybe $1 a year for a long period of time. And who really cares? Because you can't use that property unless the situation is cured and the remedy, and it needed an earthquake retrofit, and it needs all sorts of things, extremely expensive, beyond the capability of the city. So it's not the same if you do that for a dollar a year as, for instance, a fairground.
The fairgrounds, exactly.
Not the same.
I was kind of segueing into the fairgrounds.
There's time where a dollar a year makes sense, and there's time where it doesn't.
Exactly.
That all popped up in our heads. Yeah,
I know. It did.
I could see the wheels turning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So.
Sometimes a buck a year is the right amount.
Well, that's
sometimes
time
it's
not.
Not.
No, that's exactly. Well, the buck a year for the fairgrounds has been for a long time.
Yeah. I wonder if they paid for it all up front or if they just got out a buck a year.
No. He got a second on their home.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
The accounting to make sure they paid it. What a nightmare.
Oh. Yeah. Well, exactly. I'd like to actually see that accounting, see if we've ever got that money.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
I want to talk about a postcard.
Okay.
Is that okay? People say, how did you ever do this? So let's roll back the clock a little bit.
All right.
Ran for mayor in 1998 and lost, finished second in a three-way race, and was appointed to the Planning Commission. Janice was on the council that appointed me to the Planning Commission. Mm-hmm. So absent that appointment, never would have been mayor. I mean, you know, we'll talk about the things that how would have you ever been mayor. The other part of this is without campaign finance reform, and it was put in by a council that Janice was a part of. It was Janice, Jane Hamilton, David Keller, Matt McGuire, Pam Torlia. And they put in campaign finance reform that allowed access to public money if you raised a certain amount of money in a certain amount of time, so it was clearly transparent as to who it was that was funding your campaign, you could apply for a 50% match from the city. And it wasn't that it was a great deal of money, but what it gave someone like me, because I was the one that took advantage of that funding formula, it gave you the ability to plan a campaign and know that, okay, I'm going to be outspent 3 or 4 to 1, which I was, even with the public money. But I knew I'd have enough money to do such things as have a minimal number of signs, have the ability to print material so I could walk and hand out flyers to people and whatnot. So that was a component of it. Raised in small denominations, maybe as much as $10,000 and got about a $5,000 match and ran a campaign on $16,000 up against a campaign that had many times that. I don't know what they had truly. Don't remember. Don't care now. So because I don't want to mischaracterize what somebody else had. But a lot more. We had some volunteers that had a lot of compassion about wanting to get the campaign word out. So we had the financial capability of the campaign finance reform. At the very end, we had a surprise infusion of enthusiasm when they did a poll in the newspaper and found out that this wasn't a campaign that was strictly about messaging, which is how I entered it. I said, I'll do this as long as we don't define winning as who gets the most votes. It's going to be about a message. The Press Democrat does a survey, and they halted the survey because there is no statistical pattern, is what they said. And they said the mayor's race in Petaluma is a total jump ball. Holy cow, we got a chance to win this thing. And so what happens is all of a sudden it went from in the community of, well, I'm not giving my hard-earned money to that David Glass because as much as I like the message that he has, he doesn't have a chance to win, and I'm not throwing money into a sinkhole, to all of a sudden, how do I help you? And so the money comes in, and how do you spend the money? And at the very end, we're trying to figure out how to spend every allocation that we have. And this lady named Cindy Thomas puts together a package of a mailing list of people that would be sympathetic to the message, which is organized, you know, labor here in Sonoma County, specifically Petaluma. And we put out a little postcard, because that's how much money we had. And it was like, you know, was it 3x5 postcard or something
like
that?
Yeah, and I mocked it up in a Word document.
Okay.
It was simple. Yeah.
And it had my picture on it.
Yeah.
And I never wanted to use picture because I have a face for radio. You know, so the thing has my little picture on it. Now, next door are people that knew us only as Dave and Bonnie. And we knew them by first name only, and I won't say their first name because I don't want to drag them in. Mm-hmm. Maybe they don't want to be identified, and they don't live next door anymore. But here are the campaign sign, lawn sign, for whatever the time that you can have it out there, 2 months, is in our front yard. The newspaper has done whatever coverage they're doing. Candidate forums have been held right and left, many more than now is what they had. And it's the Friday before the election, and the little bit of money that we had, a couple of thousand dollars that came in as a windfall at the end, and it went to as many households as we could mail with this postcard.
Working people.
Later. Working people. Doorbell rings.
Yeah.
It's the lady that lives next door, and she's looking at the postcard and looking at my picture on the postcard and looking up and looking at me and looking back at the postcard and looking back up. And you think as a campaign you have worn it out. You have done absolutely everything, and anybody and everybody knows at least who you are. They may not like you, but they know who you are. This lady looks at a poster, a picture on the postcard one more time and looks up and says, "It's you!" Five voters in her household.
Right.
So there's five votes right there because she realized it's me. Yeah. At the end, they added up the votes in that election, and remember the polling had come out to where this is a jump ball. Boy, did they poll that accurately. 78-vote margin.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you say we have the former mayor with us, the retired mayor, whatever it is, never would have had that title at all. The postcard, the campaign finance reform, getting appointed to the planning commission, all of those things. So you two share the blame in me being mayor.
Yeah. Well, you know, the Argus Courier or the newspapers absolutely attacked me and attacked me and attacked me. And there was some confusion if Clark, since we had, I was Cater Thompson, if he was Thompson, thought we were married.
Oh, no.
Yes.
Oh.
And so the newspapers, by attacking me, actually were attacking Clark Thompson at the same time.
See, I never would have wanted about
it. Exactly. And they didn't realize this. And this is the power of the press.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah. Yep.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, you go back and you try to laugh about this stuff.
Interesting times.
And I would like to say that Clark and I became friends. We went to Washington lobbying together, and I talked a bit about that to Matt Brown in the article that they wrote, the start of the month of January. And I really did enjoy that trip with Clark to Washington, D.C., and I think that we had a chance to spend some time away from anything that was political, both of us going on a mission to raise money.
Exactly.
And Clark had some tremendous relationships in Washington, D.C., and he was very instrumental in getting the groundwork laid with some of the congressional people. So.
And he has quite the sense of humor.
Yes, he does. He's
a funny guy.
He is pretty funny.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's right. I know, one person in Washington, they go, "Well, wait a minute. I thought you were mayor," and they pointed to Clark. And they said, "Now you tell me that this guy's the mayor?" And I just looked and I said, "Well, we take turns."
You just stayed a little bit longer.
I stayed a little bit longer, yeah. I stayed long enough, because what happens is you've done what you can do.
That's right.
You did it as hard as you could do it, and you did. And at the end of the day, you left it all on the field, and that's it. And it's up to somebody else to take the baton and run with it. And
well, it's interesting because with Jake McKenzie, that's been in the newspaper and this CASA discussion, and it was definitely a coup to get him out by some people, at least on his city council. But you're kind of looking at the dynamics now around the county, who got appointed, and the dynamics, he's been on there for 18 years. And what you're really seeing, there's a change going on in Sonoma County.
There's going to be a change whether you fight it or not.
That's
you
right.
might as well embrace it because
That's right.
all of us are here for a limited time.
That's right.
We just don't know what the limit is on our time.
That's exactly right. So I think change is good. It's hard to swallow, especially if you're the one being knocked out. But Jake was a great leader, and he really did a lot for SMART, and at least he'll still be on MTC, Metropolitan Transportation Authority. But, it really knocked you out.
I don't know who got appointed. I haven't followed that. Have they done that yet?
Someone from Cloverdale, and then Rogers
okay,
from
so
Santa
Melanie,
Rosa.
Melanie Bagby got appointed from Cloverdale.
So she got appointed, and then Chris Rogers, Santa Rosa.
Okay, so Melanie Bagby is a good appointment. This is not against Jake.
Right.
But here you've got a community that was left out when
exactly.
they should have been included in.
That's right.
And so that part of it is good. Chris Rogers is the new blood. And that's in Santa Rosa. That's where much of the ridership has to come from because that's where the population is.
Right.
So it's hard to argue against either, but change, it's hard, like you say, things need to be changed, And when you're the change,
it's hard.
It's hard.
Yeah.
Exactly. Jake is a good man. He's a, you know, for people that don't know, he has a PhD. I don't know. It's in something in chemicals.
In chemicals.
Yeah, and yeah. Worked for the environmental.
Worked for
protection.
The EPA. Yeah.
Good man.
Yeah.
He's volunteered so
very
many hours.
Yeah.
Very smart.
He is very smart.
Yeah. How do you get a PhD in that without being smart?
Well, I don't know.
Really?
Money?
You could do that.
Money.
No. Not.
So that was a bit disappointing, but you know we're going to move on with that, and I think it's a good thing.
You know, I want to,
or it will be a good thing.
I want to talk about the wastewater treatment plant,
okay.
If I can, because you were there, Janice, at the beginning of that,
or
at least in the middle of it, because it had gone on for like 20 years by the time I came in as mayor.
Right.
In terms of arguing back and forth, and there were so many different arguments.
Well, it started off with privatization. Versus publicly owned, and that's, I got in after the privatization had been axed. We weren't going that direction.
The interesting thing about the privatization, if they had privatized that wastewater treatment plant, because a lot of times government gets a bad name, sometimes actually government does the job better and more efficiently and more equitably than any other alternative, and this is a perfect example.
That's right.
Because the proposal to privatize the wastewater treatment plant, it would have been the first in the country, I think. There's a reason why nobody else had done it. Sometimes being first is not revolutionary new thinking. Sometimes it's misguided, perhaps. But if they had privatized, what they were proposing to do was to build a wastewater treatment plant that would treat the water less of a degree than this plant that we have treats it. It would have treated it to the required, what's called secondary level.
Mm-hmm.
Had you done that, you would have been restricted on where you could send the water for recycling purposes. Had they also gone privatization, the way they were scoping it was build the plant, have the ratepayers pay a rate that paid for the plant completely over the 30-year life of the plant. At the end of 30 years, then have the ratepayers purchase the dilapidated plant.
Exactly.
And at which time the ratepayers would have been on the hook to build another plant. So they would have built a plant that was not as sound as the one that was built, would not have treated the wastewater to the level that you could recycle it to the number of areas that were able to recycle it, for instance, to the schools for irrigation. And the ratepayers would have been on the hook not only to build a plant, but repurchase a plant and then build another plant, plus pay a fair rate of return to the private enterprise that would have owned the plant.
That's right. And the other thing is the ratepayer would have had to have paid to upgrade that plant because we could not stay with secondary water.
As it turned out.
So then that's another level that we haven't really ever talked about.
Isn't that something?
Yeah, it really was something.
The wastewater treatment plant, though, is a crown jewel of this town. And
yes,
when people say, what's the number one thing that was accomplished for this town in that time frame, I want to be careful to make sure people understand. I'm not saying I did it. I'm saying that's what happened during this course of time. The planning was started, and actually the plan was identified and all but adopted by the time I became mayor. And then we had to modify it at the demand of the Army Corps of Engineers because the plan that we had was sited in a way that would have infringed on 14 acres of wetlands.
Yeah.
And so the plant had to be twisted and rotated and moved, and that required a different footprint. But it was the same plant. So the plant stayed the same. The footprint was altered to accommodate the wetlands. And that wastewater treatment plant was built, and it was built in such a way that we're able to get through the drought. And supply some water to some agricultural interests that otherwise would have been pumping well water. And we know now well water and its depletion rate is crucial in California, and it's having to be quantified.
Right. So. Well, just a little history on the purchase of the property.
Mm-hmm.
I remember because I was on the city council at the time, and I had cousins that actually worked for the Coastal Conservancy. And this would have been a really good marriage between the Coastal Conservancy and the Open Space District to purchase this piece of property. And I remember Council Member Healy, he said, well, if you get the money for the property, then we'll go ahead and do the type of plant that we were talking about with the polishing ponds, the trails, so it would be publicly integrated. And I don't think he ever thought I was able to get that money.
You did get the money. It was like $4 million in change.
It was $4 million in change.
Tell us how you did it.
How I did it. Well, actually, well, a long story. My uncle died, and my cousins, we were at the house kind of looking through pictures, and they happened to work for Coastal Conservancy, and I said, hey, you want to take a ride with me? I want to show you a piece of property.
I'm taking a few rides with you.
Exactly. A lot of people around. And so Maxine from Spellman and Neil Fishman, we drove over to close to the property. We get out of the van, and I said, see this beautiful piece of property. And they looked at it, and they said, oh, I think we could maybe integrate that. And so they started, we started working with the Open Space District. And we would have meetings, we would have packets connected, trying to explain to them why this was a benefit. And there were a lot of leaders in this community that came on these tours of the property. I mean, it was, it's way too many people to even get into.
Yeah.
But in the end, they were very instrumental because it was near and dear to their heart because it's a community that they ended up moving back into, you know, about 10 years ago after retiring from Coastal Conservancy. And they already worked with the Sonoma County Open Space District all the time with projects. And so they weren't new to the new on the scene. And so that's how we ended up getting the money, but it was a lot of work. And then I was working with Chip McCauley, and he was with the Argus Courier. Mm-hmm. Chip and I came up with an idea. Why don't we start a group? And it was called the Petaluma Wetlands Park Alliance. Mm-hmm. So Chip and I actually started the group, and then we brought Gerald Moore in. We brought Bob Dyer in. Betty Howland was part of it. David Yeardsley was part of it. And that, and then Patricia Johansson, an environmental artist, we would be talking with her. We brought her into, not the group, but we brought her to Petaluma to show the project and what she could actually, let me tell you about how Patricia Johansson got here. Scott Hess met her, I believe, on an airplane. And he was talking about Petaluma and that we wanted to do a Golden Gate Park or a, you know, New York Park up the middle of the Corona Reach. We wanted to preserve this area because it floods. And so we were looking at putting amphitheaters down there, public trails for, you know, for the public to use. And Patricia says, oh, where's this at? And he says, Petaluma. And she goes, oh, I'm doing a college tour with my son, and I'm driving through Petaluma. And she's from Albany, New York.
What are the chances?
Wow. What are the chances?
Yeah.
So when they came down from Oregon, they stopped in Petaluma, and that's how I met Patricia Johansson.
Well, I'll tell you what, Janice turns all the stones because my wife and I, we were going on a camping trip. It was that stage of our life with our daughter and stuff. And one of the places that we then had to go was drive through Arcata to see a wastewater treatment plant.
That's right. I went up there and I met Dan Houser, who was he was a senator or a congressman. And then he was the city manager up in Arcata. So, of course, you know, we go up to Redway, which is on the Eel River, and my mother-in-law has a home up there for the summer. And so I went up to Arcata by myself, and I went right to City Hall, and I went right to the city manager's office. He dropped everything and I got in his car, and he gave me a tour of the wastewater plant.
So this is the thing people say when you're running for mayor, and they go, well, what are the three things that you're going to do? And I said, look, you know, now that I've been mayor for a while, and I said, it's not the three things you're going to do, because you'll be lucky if you ever get around to those to accomplish them, because the things that people want are of such knowledge in the community that they've been out there for so long that maybe they happen a long time later. Like, let's say if it was the Poly Class Center. That's been going on for decades.
Right.
It's finally on an agenda to move it forward and accomplish it. And so I'll tell people, and I mean it, they think I'm dodging the question. I'll say, it's the 300 things you're going to do that you didn't even know existed before
That's
you're
right.
ever going to get around to the three
That's
things
right.
you think you're going to do.
Well, I appreciate on your camping trip that you went to Arcata, and it was a beautiful plant.
Oh, yeah, it was nice. But, I mean, you know, hey, it's hard sell. We're on our vacation. Where do you want to go? Well, I got to go see this sewer.
Well, I really appreciate that. More than you know now.
Oh, Bonnie.
You have to tell Bonnie that one. No, it's, you know, it's interesting. You have to have an open mind. You have to work really hard when you're on a city council. And when you have a vision of something, it is, I mean, you just work and work and work and work and work hard for it. And in the end result, you had a lot of good people. Once I was off the council, I still worked in the background on this. But, you know, you had great leadership with you, and you had Pam. Torliette, and it was really the leadership at City Hall also.
What the darndest thing was that now you're going to build this plant. And it was predicated on state revolving loan financing funds. And so you go through all of the plans and all of the time frame, and the state, as they're subject to do from time to time, the state revolving loan controlled the program. Done. And that's financing at about 40% the cost of regular financing. And so it really was the skill of Joe Nason, and Carol Migden was part of it,
right,
and Governor Schwarzenegger, who, if people listen to my radio program, I'm not a big fan of Schwarzenegger in a lot of ways, yeah, as far as his government, as his time as governor. But without particularly Joe Nation and Governor Schwarzenegger, who restored the program on the financing. Mike Bond was city engineer by then.
Right.
Tom Hargis had been the engineer for a long time. Mike Bond worked on this. Mike Bierman, our city manager at the mm-hmm. time. And I did a couple of lobbying trips up there. I mean, you know, that's kind of the role of the mayor, as you go along and you put in your 2 cents worth in between the experts' comments. That's all. So it's more of a, well, it's just a support role. But I saw it. I saw what these people did. And without them, the money would not have been available to have built the plant.
You really understand finances. And I really think that was a benefit for many projects, but for the wastewater specifically. You were a leader in that. It was, you might have worked with them, and they are the ones that had to make it happen, but you had to make the sell. And if anything you can do, David, you can sell.
Thank you.
You can sell ice to an Eskimo.
Probably that would be really hard frozen ice in Chicago today, wouldn't it?
But it is important to understand the finances, and you can pull that up because you really understand it. And that takes leadership. And that's what this community had with you, is leadership. And I just want to thank you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure. I mean, you know, there were a lot of people. When you start saying what happened with these projects, there were a lot of people. I was asked what I regret. In some ways, what I regret is we never got a chance to see what John Brown could have done, because there was no chance to build anything during, really. I mean, there was no funds with us to release and go for it. So John was here at a time that was so important for the city, because it was a constant paring down of expenditures, and it kept the city surviving. And so I got to look at the city both ways. I got to look at the boom times, and we were booming when we had redevelopment. And so that added to the boom.
Yeah.
And then you see what it's like. And I came back on purpose when it was the bust times, because I thought I could help talk people through it. I found no matter how much talking you can do and no matter how much understanding of finance you have, sometimes the message is so harsh that people want to think that there's another answer when there really isn't. And it ripples throughout the whole spectrum, from people that wanted moderate and low-cost housing built without the financial capability, to people that want and deserve pay raises but without the financial capability to give them what they actually deserve, because there's some really talented, good people at City Hall, and there was not the money there to increase. Instead, we were always decreasing, and the decreasing, it hurt. It hurt a lot. To see people, you know, losing their jobs. I've been in a position where I've lost jobs. I know what that is. Nobody wants to go home and tell their family that they've been downsized out. And it happened to a lot of people. We tried to do it with compassion. We tried to do it with an understanding that it had a real impact on good people that you cared about. And so we went as slowly as possible with it. And we brought that reserve fund at one time down to $5,000.
I remember that.
That's a couple of hours of operating
funds. That's like a blink.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
It never actually hit that level because of the skill of John Brown of managing through the crisis. But I do think internally they had to borrow from reserves to meet cash flow needs until revenue came in, but they never officially went over and into the red. And then, you know, at the end of John's tenure, they brought it back up. We brought it back up. With priorities. And so everything was prioritized. One thing that hurt in this last election was seeing people not recognizing what was done to preserve the assets of the city and preserve to the degree possible services, and by saying, well, all you have to do is reprioritize.
Well,
there was nothing left there to reprioritize. So the city will face that
right.
at some time in the future, and they will face it with that ugly word of do you want to pay some kind of a additional tax
yep.
to have some funds to prioritize.
Well, that segues us into SB 152.
There needs to be an O in there somewhere on that.
Yeah.
Well, this morning I was reading in the Argus or in the Press Democrat, and it was called Pulling a Tax Bill Out of a Hat. And it's talking about it was talking about Proposition 54, which was approved in 2016, blocked some of the worst abuses, but there are also some surprises. One of them is Senate Bill 152, which was an innocuous measure involving Medi-Cal records when it was introduced in 2017. After passing through the Senate and reaching the Assembly floor for a final vote, presto chango, SB 52 exempts Sonoma County from the 9.25% cap on sales tax. The rules are suspended. The bill zipped through in 7 days, passing on party line votes, and it was called to our attention last week by a reader. And so this is very interesting to me because out of the entire state of California, Sonoma County doesn't have a cap. And I think it was recently they were talking about doing a 1% increase in taxes for the entire county for fire-related infrastructure. I'm sure it was more than infrastructure. It had to do with pensions would have been paid through this. But 1% is a really, you know, it's a big chunk. And I believe that it went down this last week to move forward with that. Something happened at the county.
It's hard for me to speak to that because I don't have all of the information. So just,
nor do I.
So we just can speak generically about it. First of all, a sales tax, that's what California has pushed itself into. And it's a regressive form of taxation. And that's what's fundamentally unfair about it, is that it takes an equal amount of money away from people regardless of their ability to pay it.
Right.
And I think that it probably hits those that don't have the capability of managing through that even harder because they may not be able to transport themselves to another jurisdiction to buy the same goods.
Right.
Where people that have a lot of affluency about it, it will influence their behavior. It won't change where they buy an automobile because your residence goes with you.
That's right.
But to raise something and think it's only a penny, it's not. It's a penny on every dollar that you have on expenditures that you're making. And so you talk about something that's inflationary or hard-hitting. I think when the state set a cap, some lawyer probably said, and now I'm making this up, okay, so I'm hypothecating. But did some lawyer say, you know what, legally we have to put a cap? And so these politicians all get together and they agree, the cap will be 9.25%, and everybody's laughing. We met the legal test to set a cap that we'll never hit. So it's the perfect solution. We appeared to have solved the problem, which is what happens too often in politics. Appearance more than effectiveness is often the gauge. Well, here, can you imagine that we're at 9.25%?
Well, Catani is already at 9.25%. And so I looked at that and I'm thinking, well, they realize that Catani's at 9.25%, so how are we going to solve this in the entire county? They'd be up to 10.25%.
Well, nowhere in the jurisdiction can go above when you do a jurisdiction-wide rate.
Right.
No one in the jurisdiction, you're pegged to the lowest. Did they put no cap on it at all?
I don't know. I'm going to have to go read. I just read this morning, and so I think it's just something that I'm going to start looking into because I'm curious who lobbied for this. Was it Platinum Consulting? Was it?
I have no idea.
I have no idea what consultants or were lobbying for this, where the supervisors are, because I'm sure the supervisors had to have been lobbying in their lobbying firms, whoever lobbies for them. And so it's just something that I would really like to look into. But also, I want to go into the shutdown. I don't think people realize when it was shut down how many people live on the edge. And then you had government workers who will actually get probably back pay, but then you had contract workers that are not going to get back pay. And I think people forget about people other than ourselves and who can afford what. When you are on the edge, you have to really stop and reflect, or for myself, I stop and reflect about what other people are going through. And then I think this is a whole other topic, but the cost of cell phones, the cost of cable, all of these costs are so high. People are just constantly paying to keep the capitalism going in this country, and they don't really realize it. And the shutdown was a big wake-up call or an eye-opener for, not myself, but for myself, but a lot of other people also, I hope, that we realize that we can't just think of ourselves. We need to look at the bigger picture.
It'll be interesting to see what the ramification of this is in a few years, because I think one way government attracts a qualified workforce, and there's some very qualified people that we've come in contact with by having been there. When you start seeing people go into government work, usually they want to provide a service to the public. They also want the security of knowing that they have a job in the location that they choose to live in and that it's secure. And so the cash flow is secure. The pay may be beneath the scale of the private sector and often is. But at the end, there's a pension that is different now than most of the private sector offers. And so there's a retirement at the end of the rainbow. Now you start putting in this management style at a federal government level, and all of a sudden the security is out the window, and I think you're going to pay for that by having a harder time to attract qualified workers that would go into government service, because if they can't count on the pay, and if the pay is substandard, and the volatility is subject to a political whim, and the political process itself proves to be dysfunctional, and this one is proving that, what's the attraction?
Well, that, you know, that's what we've seen, you know, with the FBI. I mean, firing qualified people. And what's going to happen to the FBI? What's going to happen with the CIA? What's going to happen with world?
The quality of the work is going to continue to decline.
Exactly.
But the quality of work at the FBI is exceptionally high.
Absolutely.
And anybody that buys into that it isn't...
is wrong.
Well, I mean, you know, that's a naive approach that you could think that a politician, for instance, any politician, is selling you on the idea that the dedicated professionals such as the FBI or the CIA... That's sad.
These are dedicated people, and they are well-educated. They do an excellent job, and now they're being questioned.
And they go where the truth takes them.
Yes, they do. Oh, and it takes a long time to find the truth, as we can see with Bob Mueller, how long it's taking and how qualified he is. Mm-hmm. So it's... life is interesting, and we'll just keep on rolling.
Well, you've been listening to Inside Petaluma. I'm Cindy Thomas, co-hosting with Janice Keeter-Thompson, and today we have retired Mayor David Glass with us. And what else do we want to talk about? We've got a few more minutes.
I'll talk quickly. I just see that David Brooks is in the has an article today, or a column in the Press Democrat. But David Brooks is coming through Literacy Works to Sonoma County, and I think it is in May. I'll update you on that, but I think it's going to be a good event, and I think it'll be in Santa Rosa, not in Petaluma, because we need a large venue, and it should be interesting to hear, you know, his point of view and hear him as a lecturer.
It will, because there's somebody that is taking on the current administration that is very much a Republican.
That's right.
Very much a Republican, and it makes you wonder what has happened to the Republican Party, and where would Ronald Reagan be today? Because Ronald Reagan said, growing up as a Democrat, he didn't leave the Democratic Party, it left him. And I would have to think that the Republican Party, as it's construed, at least for the moment, and I hope this is a blip in time, and I'm certainly not a Republican, but I have friends that are Republicans. Mm-hmm. I hope this is a blip in time, and that this is not truly what is left as an alternative for us in a two-party system.
Exactly.
Because we're a two-party system.
Yeah.
And if we're so far on one side of the scale that Donald Trump is leading right now, that's dangerous. And I think that the same thing is true when you go on the far left, is that somewhere we've got to find a way to get to something in the middle range. And that middle is a wide middle. It should be the 80%.
Exactly. Yeah.
And that's where you should be. Each side should be, you know, as much as I didn't like Nixon, Nixon used to say that you ran as a Republican now. Nixon would say you run to the right to get the nomination, and then you got to run back and move to the middle to get the election.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like today you run to the left to get the nomination, and then you got to go further left to get the election, or you run to the right to get the nomination, and then go further right to get the election.
It certainly appears that way.
Yeah, it certainly does.
We're having simultaneous revolutions on the right and the left at the same time, and the people in the middle are watching all of this dysfunction and government shut down. Government's got to govern. You know, I used to tell people, I said, okay, so the first Tuesday of November at 8 o'clock at night, the election is over. And now it's time to govern.
That's right.
And at City Hall, I think they do a pretty good job of that, because if you don't, your town falls apart.
That's right.
We need to do it across the political spectrum. There comes a time to end the election and govern.
And govern. It's very true. Yeah.
And that's the rest of the story.
I'm done. I don't have anything else to add.
Wow, that's a shock.
I know. I'd actually like to talk about South America, Venezuela, and all of that and what's going on down there, but that's another story.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
We were in Havana, and 8 days later, the tornado came.
Oh, yeah.
Man, am I glad we weren't there, you know.
All right. Well, thank you, David, for being here today, and...
We'll be back next week.
We will be back next week. We're here every Friday from 11 to noon, and it's Inside Petaluma with myself, Cindy Thomas, and Janice Peter Thompson, and Jason Davies, who's not with us today. Jason, if you're out there and you're listening, I hope you feel better. We miss you.
Yes, we do.
And if anybody missed this show, you can catch it on our website, insidepetaluma.com. We have all of our episodes there. And that's it, I think. Oh, our Facebook page, KPCA Inside Petaluma. Go like it. We're very likable, aren't we?
We're very likable.
Very
likable.
All right. All right, so everybody have a great weekend. David, have a good time tonight. Oh, you're going
I'm going also, yes.
Yeah, I can't get a ticket. Are there any scalpers out there?
Well, you know, I don't think so. And Jerry said he'd go with me, but if he changes his mind, would you be my date?
I'm going to the ladies' wine club.
Oh, okay.
It's canned wine. Canned wine is the sponsored wine club.
Interesting.
It's going to be interesting. I'll have to bring a flask. Okay, so have a good day. See you all next week.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.